A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been digging into the Eurocontainer rabbit hole, and he's hit the same wall everyone hits. These things are standardized, stackable, nearly indestructible. The unsung hero of industrial logistics. But when you try to buy one for your garage, you're staring down pallet minimums, B2B gatekeepers, and sellers who act like you're asking them to break federal law by selling you 3 boxes instead of 300. So, the secondhand market looks like the obvious move.
That's where it gets interesting, because the secondhand market for industrial containers is this weird bazaar of packaging recyclers, liquidation brokers, and guys on Facebook Marketplace who can't tell you what was in the container but swear it's basically new.
Daniel's cool question is, how do you avoid bringing home a container that's been marinating in something you don't want in your living space? If it held chemicals, is it permanently unsuitable? If it held food, can you actually sanitize it? And how do you assess whether a seller is being honest about what the thing held before it landed in their warehouse?
This is a material science question disguised as a shopping question, and I love it. The thing most people don't realize is that HDPE, high-density polyethylene, what these containers are made of. It's not a solid wall like glass. It's semi-crystalline. About 60 to 80% crystalline structure, and the rest is amorphous regions where small molecules can actually diffuse into the polymer matrix.
The plastic is more like a sponge than a wall, just on a molecular level.
That's why HDPE is used for chemical containers in the first place. It resists attack, it doesn't corrode, but it's not an impermeable barrier forever. Certain chemicals will partition right into those amorphous regions and then slowly release over time. You can scrub the surface until it gleams and still have contaminants off-gassing from inside the plastic itself.
Which means the sniff test at the seller's warehouse tells you almost nothing useful.
Perchloroethylene, industrial degreaser used in dry cleaning. It can penetrate HDPE, and the container will pass a surface swab test and still off-gas trace amounts for years. You seal it up for 24 hours, open it, and there it is. But in the moment, standing in some guy's lot with the wind blowing, you'd never know.
The question isn't really, can I clean this? It's, can I trust where this came from?
That's the better framing. And Daniel's right to ask about supplier honesty because the incentives in the secondhand market are not aligned with full disclosure. A packaging recycler who bought a lot of 500 containers from a factory closure. They might genuinely not know what was in half of them. A liquidation broker is moving volume. They're not running gas chromatography on every box.
The individual seller on eBay who lists heavy-duty storage totes with a photo that shows a faded UN marking and what looks like a residue ring. That person either doesn't know or doesn't want to know.
UN markings are actually a useful tell. If you see something like UN 1H1 stamped on the side, that means the container was certified for hazardous material transport. Doesn't automatically mean it's contaminated, but it tells you this thing lived in a regulated chemical supply chain at some point. That's information.
We've got a spectrum. On one end, containers with documented lineage from food-grade industries, bakeries, pharmaceutical excipient manufacturers, breweries, where the previous contents are known and low risk. On the other end, mystery boxes with solvent residue and a seller who suddenly gets vague when you ask what they held.
In between, a whole lot of containers that probably held something innocuous, but the seller can't prove it. That's where the practical verification methods come in. The 24-hour sealed sniff test. UV fluorescence for organic residues. Simple pH strips for acid or base contamination. These aren't lab-grade tests, but they'll catch the obvious problems.
What about the bleach and water approach? The, I'll just give it a good scrub, instinct?
That's one of the misconceptions I want to tackle head-on. Bleach, sodium hypochlorite, is great for disinfecting surfaces against bacteria and viruses. It's useless against organic chemicals that have diffused into the polymer. And in some cases, it can actually react with chemical residues to form hazardous byproducts. You're not cleaning the container, you're just adding another chemical to the mix.
The good wash instinct can make things worse.
It absolutely can. And that's before we even get into the difference between food-grade and industrial-grade HDPE. Food-grade has to use virgin resin. FDA 21 CFR 1C720 specifies this. Industrial containers can use post-consumer recycled HDPE, which means the plastic itself might contain residual contaminants from the recycling stream before it ever held anything.
You're potentially dealing with two layers of unknown history. What the container held, and what the plastic was made from in the first place.
For a domestic setting, storing clothes, bedding, kids' toys, pantry items, that matters. The threshold for safe enough for the garage is different from safe enough for the bedroom.
Which brings us back to Daniel's practical dilemma. The first-hand market is hostile to individual buyers. The second-hand market is full of unknowns. And the gap between industrial-grade storage and consumer-grade junk has never been wider.
I think what Daniel's really asking is, can you navigate this market safely, or is the risk just baked in? And I'd say you can navigate it, but you need a framework, not just a checklist. You need to understand what HDPE does with different chemicals, which industries are safe bets, and how to read a seller in 30 seconds.
Let's build that framework. Start with the materials science. What actually happens when different chemicals meet HDPE, and then work forward to the practical stuff, vetting sellers, running tests, knowing when to walk away.
The permeation mechanics are where everything starts. I mentioned the semicrystalline structure. The amorphous regions are the vulnerable zones. Nonpolar organic solvents, toluene, xylene, components of gasoline. These have what chemists call high log P values, typically 2 to 3 or higher. Log P is a measure of how a compound partitions between water and an organic solvent like octanol. High log P means it prefers the organic phase. It'll happily diffuse into those amorphous regions of HDPE and stay there.
The chemical's log P is basically a predictor of how deeply it's going to embed itself in the plastic.
Polar compounds, acids, bases, alcohols, they're less likely to penetrate deeply because they don't partition as readily into the nonpolar polymer matrix. Heavy metals don't permeate at all. They're too large and charged. But they can adsorb onto surface micro cracks and scratches, especially in older containers that have seen wear.
Which means the container's physical condition matters too. A scratched up interior has more surface area for stuff to cling to.
Micro cracks can trap residues that simple rinsing won't reach. I saw a case from an industrial hygiene report where used IBC totes, those 275-gallon cubes, had held sodium hydroxide. Surface pH was neutral after rinsing. But those microcracks? Still alkaline when you probed them.
You test the smooth surface. It reads clean. And you think you're good. Meanwhile, the cracks are holding a chemistry set.
The thing is, that sodium hydroxide example is actually one of the more forgiving scenarios because it's polar. It's not diffusing into the polymer matrix, it's just mechanically trapped. A nonpolar solvent like toluene is a different beast entirely. It swells the amorphous regions and partitions in. You can't rinse it out because it's not on the surface anymore. It's in the plastic.
For the listener staring at a used container listing, the practical question is, which chemicals are the walk-away immediately ones?
Halogenated solvents are at the top of my list. Perchloroethylene, trichloroethylene, methylene chloride. These are small, nonpolar molecules that penetrate HDPE readily, and they're all classified as probable or known carcinogens. Pesticides and industrial biocides are the next tier. They're designed to be biologically active at low concentrations, which is exactly what you don't want off-gassing in your home. And then there's the broad category of unknown chemical mixtures. If the seller says it held some kind of cleaning solution and can't be more specific, you have to assume the worst.
What about the containers that held food? Daniel asks specifically about sanitization.
Food residues are a fundamentally different problem. Flour, sugar, vegetable shortening, these are water-soluble or emulsifiable. Hot water, detergent, and some elbow grease will handle them. Oils are trickier because they can go rancid in micro-scratches, but they're not a toxicity concern in the same way. The real watch-out with food containers is allergens. Peanut oil, soy lecithin, gluten-containing flours. If someone in your household has a severe allergy, even a thoroughly clean container that held those could be a risk. Proteins can hang on to scratched HDPE surfaces with surprising tenacity.
Food containers are generally cleanable, but generally is doing some work there.
And that brings us to the distinction between food-grade and industrial-grade HDPE, which matters more than most people realize. Food-grade HDPE, under FDA 21 CFR 77-25-20, has to use virgin resin. No post-consumer recycled content. The entire manufacturing chain is controlled. Industrial-grade containers can and often do use recycled HDPE, which means the plastic arrives at the factory already carrying whatever it absorbed in its previous life. Before the container ever held anything, the walls themselves might have a history.
You're not just asking what was stored in the box. You're asking what the box was before it was a box.
That recycled HDPE could have been detergent bottles, motor oil containers, industrial drums. The recycling process melts it down and reforms it, but it doesn't erase the chemical history. Some contaminants survive the melt and re-extrusion. So, an industrial container made from recycled resin might off-gas trace compounds that have nothing to do with what it most recently held. They're ghosts from the plastic's previous incarnation.
Which makes the documentation chain even more important than it first appears. You're not just verifying the last contents. You're verifying that the container was manufactured for food contact from the start.
That's why I'd argue that for indoor domestic use, especially anywhere near food, clothing, or sleeping areas, you really want containers with documented food-grade lineage. The premium you pay for that is buying certainty. Without it, you're running a long-term, low-dose exposure experiment, and you're the subject.
Let's move from the science to the shopping. You're standing in front of a pallet of used containers, or scrolling a listing, and you need to figure out who you're actually dealing with. The secondhand market breaks down into roughly three types of sellers.
First, packaging recyclers. These are companies that buy used containers in bulk from factories, food processors, pharmaceutical plants. They clean them, grade them, resell them. They're the most likely to have documentation, manifests, cleaning certificates, lot numbers. Second, liquidation brokers. These are the middlemen who buy entire warehouses when a business closes. They're moving volume fast, and they often don't know what was in every container. They might have a manifest for the lot, but not for individual units. Third, the individual seller on eBay or Facebook Marketplace. Could be someone who bought a pallet at auction and is flipping them. Could be someone cleaning out a deceased relative's workshop. The knowledge level ranges from pretty informed to, I found these behind the shed.
Your first move isn't inspecting the container. It's inspecting the seller.
The fastest filter is asking one question. Can you tell me, in writing, what this container previously held? If the answer is vague, industrial use, cleaning supplies, nothing hazardous, that's not an answer. That's a deflection. A seller who knows will say, vegetable shortening from a commercial bakery, or sodium chloride tablets from a pharmaceutical plant. Specificity is the honesty signal.
Food grade, without documentation, that's just a word.
It's a marketing claim, not a certification. I've seen listings where the container has a visible residue ring and the seller still claims food grade. The documentation chain that actually matters has three links. The original manufacturer's data sheet for the container itself, the previous contents manifest if it came from a regulated industry, and any cleaning or decontamination certificates. In practice, most sellers won't have all three, but the ones who have even one of those are operating at a completely different level of professionalism. They're worth paying a premium for.
What's the premium we're talking about?
A used Euro container from a packaging recycler with documented food industry lineage might run you $8 to $12. The mystery box on Facebook Marketplace? $3 to $5. You're paying double or triple for certainty. But replacing a wardrobe full of clothes that have absorbed toluene odor, or dealing with a kid's skin reaction to trace pesticide residue, that costs a lot more than the $6 you saved.
The cheap container isn't cheap. It's just deferring the cost to a different ledger.
Now, if you're standing in front of a container and the seller's claims seem plausible but you want to verify, there's a hierarchy of practical tests. Visual inspection first. Look for staining, especially in corners and along the bottom seam. Look for swelling or warping. That's a sign a solvent was in there and caused the polymer to expand. Look for faded labels, UN markings, residue rings. Any of those and the seller's story had better match what you're seeing.
If it doesn't match.
A seller who says use for water on a container with a UN 1H1 hazardous material stamp and a dark stain in the corner is either lying or clueless, and neither one sells you a safe container.
The UN stamp is almost a reverse pedigree.
It tells you this container was born into the chemical logistics world. That doesn't make it automatically dangerous. Plenty of hazmat-certified containers held benign materials, but it means the burden of proof shifts to the seller. They need to explain what it held, not the other way around.
Visual inspection first.
The 24-hour sealed sniff test. This is the single highest value test you can do at home. Seal the container completely, lid on, latches down, wait 24 hours, open it, and put your nose right inside. Any chemical odor, any sweetness, any solvent note, anything that doesn't smell like clean plastic, that's residual contamination off-gassing. It doesn't matter if the surface looks pristine. Your nose is detecting what's desorbing from the polymer matrix.
This works even for chemicals that don't have a strong smell.
It works for a surprising range of them. The human nose can detect some compounds at parts per billion concentrations. It won't catch everything. Benzene, for example, has a relatively high odor threshold compared to its toxicity, but it'll catch a lot. If you want to go further, a UV flashlight is maybe a $20 investment. Many organic residues fluoresce under UV. You shine it inside a container that looked clean under normal light, and suddenly you see handprints, strip marks, residue patterns. It's unsettling how much a UV light reveals.
The Forensic Cleanup Crew Toolkit.
pH test strips are another cheap addition. If the container held something acidic or caustic, a quick swipe of a damp strip along the interior surface can catch it. These aren't laboratory-grade methods, but together they form a pretty effective screening protocol. Visual, sniff, UV, pH. If a container passes all four and the seller's story checks out, you're in reasonably good shape.
If it fails any of them?
Depends which one. A container that held flour might have some dusty residue but passed the sniff and UV tests. That's a cleaning problem, not a contamination problem. A container that glows under UV and smells vaguely sweet after 24 hours sealed. That's a permanent no for indoor use. Garage storage for tools and car supplies maybe, but not your bedroom closet.
There's a tiered approach. Some containers are safe after cleaning, some are safe only for non-porous, non-living space use, and some are permanently unsuitable, period.
The permanently unsuitable category has clear boundaries. Halogenated solvents, pesticides, and industrial biocides, unknown chemical mixtures where the seller can't or won't specify. Those three categories I would not bring into a domestic space under any circumstances. The risk-reward math simply doesn't work.
Which brings us to the positive side of the equation. If you're going to hunt for used containers, where should you actually be looking?
This is the market hack Daniel's really going to appreciate. Don't search for used Euro containers. Search for the industries that use them and have predictable, low-risk contents. Commercial bakeries. Their containers held shortening, flour, sugar. Pharmaceutical excipient manufacturers. Starch, lactose, microcrystalline, cellulose. Breweries, hops, grain, malt. These are all food-grade supply chains with documentation requirements baked into their operations. When they surplus containers, the containers come with a paper trail.
You're not buying a container. You're buying the supply chain it came from.
A container from a bakery ingredient supplier that held vegetable shortening. That's a known quantity. The shortening was food-grade. The container was food-grade. The supplier probably has a manifest. The packaging recycler who handles their surplus probably specializes in food industry plastics. Every link in that chain reduces your risk.
The practical move is to find those recyclers and build a relationship.
Ask if they handle food industry surplus. Ask to be notified when they get a lot in. Most of these businesses are B2B, and they're not set up for individual buyers walking in off the street, but many of them will sell smaller quantities if you're polite, you know what you're asking for, and you're willing to pay cash. You're not their primary customer, but you're also not a hassle if you make it easy for them.
The eBay listing, with the residue ring and the faded UN stamp. That's the opposite of this approach. That's buying a story you hope is true.
Hoping is not a verification strategy. The whole framework we've been building, understand the chemistry, vet the seller, run the tests, target safe industries, it all converges on one principle. You're not trying to prove a container is safe. You're trying to fail to prove it's dangerous. If you can't prove it's dangerous after a reasonable effort, it's probably fine. But if there's any evidence you can't explain away, any test result that doesn't align with the seller's story, any gap in the documentation, that's your answer.
Let's distill this into something you can actually use. You're scrolling listings or standing in a warehouse. What's the checklist?
1. Ask for the previous contents in writing. Not verbally, not the guy said. If they won't put it in a message, that's your first red flag. 2. Inspect for UN markings. UN1H1 or similar means this container was certified for hazardous material transport. Not automatically a deal breaker, but the burden of proof just flipped to the seller. 3. The 24-hour sealed sniff test. Seal it, wait, open it, smell. Any chemical note, you're done. 4. Avoid anything that held solvents, pesticides, or unknown mixtures. Those are the permanently unsuitable categories. 5. Target food industry surplus. Bakeries, breweries, pharmaceutical excipient suppliers. Known contents, documented supply chains.
The premium for that documented lineage. You said double or triple the mystery box price.
$8 to $12 instead of $3 to $5. That $6 savings evaporates the moment you have to replace a closet full of clothes that smell like a dry cleaner. Or worse, deal with a kid's skin reaction to something you can't even identify. Cheap containers aren't cheap. They're just billing you later.
If you've already got containers and you can't verify them, you inherited them, you bought them before you knew better. What's the rule?
If you can't verify, don't use them indoors. Repurpose them for the garage. Tools, car supplies, things that don't absorb vapors and aren't pressed against your skin 8 hours a day. Never use unknown history containers for food, clothing, bedding, or anything in a kid's room. The threshold for safe enough for the garage is real and it's lower.
The long play here isn't hunting individual containers at all. It's building relationships.
That's the move that pays off over years. Find the local packaging recyclers who handle food industry surplus. Ask to be on their notification list. Over time, you stop searching and start getting calls when a bakery upgrades their container fleet. That's how you get documented, low-risk containers at bulk prices without the bulk.
It's the difference between dating around and getting married to a container supplier.
I'm not sure I'd extend the metaphor that far, but yes, the relationship is the asset. The containers are just the output.
Where does this leave us? The market for used industrial storage is only going to grow. More people optimizing smaller spaces. More awareness that consumer storage is disposable junk. The question is whether the second-hand market matures into something transparent or splits into two tiers.
I think the split is already happening. You've got packaging recyclers who specialize in food industry surplus, who document their chain, who can tell you exactly what a container held and when. They're effectively creating a certified clean tier, whether they call it that or not. And then you've got everybody else. The liquidation brokers, the mystery pallet flippers, the heavy-duty tote, listings with three words of description and a blurry photo.
The certified tier commands a premium that most casual buyers will balk at, because on the surface, it's the same plastic box.
Which is exactly why the buyer beware tier isn't going anywhere. There will always be people who see $8 versus $4 and make the cheaper choice. The hope is that enough information gets out there. Enough people understand the permeation science, the sniff test, the UN markings, that the bad sellers can't just coast on, "looks clean to me."
The broader thing that sticks with me is that this isn't just about Euro containers. The HDPE permeation science applies to everything made from recycled plastic. As more consumer goods incorporate post-consumer recycled HDPE, cutting boards, food storage, kids' toys, the question of what was in the plastic before it was your plastic becomes everybody's problem.
That's the sleeper issue. Right now, recycled HDPE in consumer goods is a sustainability win. Nobody's asking what that recycled HDPE used to be. But if it was a detergent bottle, a motor oil container, an industrial drum, those chemical ghosts don't necessarily vanish in the recycling process. We're going to need the same kind of provenance thinking for recycled content products that we're advocating for used industrial containers.
Daniel's garage storage question turns out to be a warm-up for a much bigger conversation about knowing what your plastic actually is.
Which is a very Daniel-shaped outcome. Start with, how do I buy a box, and end up in materials, science, and supply chain transparency.
if you've got stories. Successful container scores, disaster purchases, a seller who swore it held spring water and it turned out to smell like a paint factory. Send them in. We want to hear what's actually happening out there in the secondhand market. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
If this episode saved you from bringing a toluene-soaked mystery box into your bedroom, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show before they make expensive mistakes.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Don't buy the residue ring. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1902, a French meteorological expedition to Djibouti attempted to measure humidity using a human hair hygrometer, but the instrument kept giving erratic readings because the local barber who supplied the hair had been treating it with scented oil, which the expedition's physicist only discovered after 3 weeks of unusable data.
The barber's defense was probably that the hair looked fantastic.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.